One evening, in the winter of 1801, I met an old friend in a public park. He had recently been appointed principal dancer at the local theater and was enjoying immense popularity with the audiences. I told him I had been surprised to see him more than once at the Marionette Theater, which had been put up in the marketplace to entertain the public with dramatic burlesques interspersed with song and dance. He assured me that the mute gestures of these puppets gave him much satisfaction, and told me bluntly that any dancer who wished to perfect his art could learn a lot from them. From the way he said this, I could see it wasn't something which had just come into his mind, so I sat down to question him more closely about his reasons for this remarkable assertion. He asked me if I hadn't in fact found some of the dance movements of the puppets, and particularly of the smaller ones, to be very graceful. This I could not deny. A group of four peasants dancing the rondo in quick time could not have been painted more delicately, said I. I inquired about the mechanism of these figures. I wanted to know how it is possible, without a maze of strings attached to one's fingers, to move the separate limbs and extremities in the rhythm of the dance. His answer was that I must not imagine each limb as being individually positioned and moved by the operator in the various phases of the dance. No, each movement, he told me, has its center of gravity. It is enough to control this within the puppet. The limbs, which are only pendulums, then follow mechanically of their own accord without further help. He added that this movement is very simple. When the center of gravity is moved in a straight line, the limbs describe curves. Often shaken in a purely haphazard way, the puppet falls into a kind of rhythmic movement which resembles dance. This observation seemed to me to throw some light at last on the enjoyment he said he got from the Marionette Theater. But I was far from guessing the inferences that he would draw from it later. I asked him if he thought the operator who controls these puppets should himself be a dancer, or at least have some idea of beauty in the dance. He replied that if a job is technically easy, it doesn't follow that it can be done entirely without sensitivity. The line the center of gravity has to follow is indeed very simple, and in most cases, he believed, straight. When it is curved, the law of its curvature seems to be at least of the first and at most of the second order. Even in the latter case, the line is only elliptical, a form of movement natural to the human body because of the joints. So this hardly demands any great skill from the operator. But seen from another point of view, this line could be something very mysterious. It is nothing other than the path taken by the soul of the dancer. He doubted if this could be found unless the operator can transpose himself into the center of gravity of the marionette. In other words, the operator dances. I said the operator's part in the business had been represented to me as something which can be done entirely without feeling, rather like turning the handle of a barrel organ. Oh, not at all, he said. In fact, there is a subtle relationship between the movements of his fingers and the movements of the puppets attached to them, something like the relationship between numbers and their logarithms, or between asymptote and hyperbola. Yet, he did not believe this last trace of human volition could be removed from the marionettes and their dance transferred entirely to the realm of mechanical forces, even produced, as I had suggested, by turning a handle. I told him I was astonished at the attention he was paying to this vulgar species of an art form. It wasn't just that he thought it capable of loftier development. He seemed to be working to this end himself. He smiled. He said he was confident that if he could get a craftsman to construct a marionette to the specifications he had in mind, he could perform a dance with it, which neither he nor any of the other skilled dancer of his time, not even Madame Vestris herself, could equal. "Have you heard," he asked, as I looked down in silence, "of those artificial legs made by English craftsmen for people who have been unfortunate enough to lose their own limbs?" I said I had not. I had never seen anything of this kind. "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that," he said, "because when I tell you these people dance with them, I'm almost afraid you won't believe me." "What am I saying? Dance? The range of their movements is in fact limited, but those that they can perform, they execute with a certainty and ease and grace, which must astound the thoughtful observer." I said with a laugh that, of course, he had now found his man. The craftsman who could make such remarkable limbs could surely build a complete marionette for him to his specifications. "And what," I asked as he was looking down in some perplexity, "are the requirements you think of presenting to the ingenuity of this man?" "Nothing that isn't to be found in these puppets we see here," he replied. "Proportion, flexibility, lightness, but all to a higher degree, and especially a more natural arrangement of the centers of gravity." And what is the advantage your puppets would have over living dancers?" I asked. "The advantage? Well, first of all, a negative one, my friend. It would never be guilty of affectation, for affectation is seen, as you know, when the soul or moving force appears at some point other than the center of gravity of the movement, because the operator controls with his wire or thread only this center. The attached limbs are just what they should be. That is, lifeless, pure pendulums, governed only by the law of gravity. This is an excellent quality. You'll look for it in vain in most of our dancers." "Just look at that girl who dances Daphne," he went on. "Pursued by Apollo, she turns to look at him. At this moment, her soul appears to be in the small of her back. As she bends, she looks as if she's going to break, like a naiad after the school of Bernini. Or take that young fellow who dances Paris when he's standing among the three goddesses and offering the apple to Venus. His soul is, in fact, located, and, oh, it's frightful to see, in his elbow." "Misconceptions like this are unavoidable," he said, "now that we've eaten of the tree of knowledge. But paradise is locked and bolted, and the cherubim stands behind us. We have to go on and make the journey round the world to see if it is perhaps open somewhere at the back." This made me laugh. Certainly, I thought, the human spirit can't be in error when it is non-existent. I could see that he had more to say, so I begged him to go on. "In addition," he said, "these puppets have the advantage of being, for all practical purposes, weightless. They are not afflicted with the inertia of matter, the property most resistant to dance. The force which raises them into the air is greater than the one which draws them to the ground. What would our good Miss G give to be 60 pounds lighter, or have a weight of this size as a counterbalance when she is performing her entrechats and pirouettes. Puppets need the ground only to glance against lightly, like elves, and through this momentary check to renew the swing of their limbs. We humans must have the ground to rest on to recover from the effort of the dance. This moment of rest is clearly no part of the dance. The best we can do is make it as inconspicuous as possible. My reply was that no matter how cleverly he might present his paradoxes, he would never make me believe that a mechanical puppet can be more graceful than a living human body. Oh, he countered this by saying that where grace is concerned, it is impossible for man to come anywhere near a puppet. Only a god can equal inanimate matter in this respect. This is the point where the two ends of the circular world meet. I was absolutely astonished. I didn't know what to say to such extraordinary assertions. It seemed, he said, as he took a pinch of snuff, that I hadn't read the third chapter of the book of Genesis with sufficient attention. If a man wasn't familiar with that initial period of all human development, it would be difficult to have a fruitful discussion with him about later developments, and even more difficult to talk about the ultimate situation. Well, I told him I was well aware how consciousness can disturb natural grace. A young acquaintance of mine had, as it were, lost his innocence before my very eyes, and all because of a chance remark. He had never found his way back to that paradise of innocence, in spite of all conceivable efforts. But what inferences, I added, can you draw from that? He asked me what incident I had in mind. Well, about 3 years ago, I said, I was at the baths with a young man who was then remarkably graceful. He was about 15, and only faintly could one see the first traces of vanity, a product of the favors shown him by women. It happened that we had recently seen in Paris the figure of the boy pulling a thorn out of his foot. The cast of the statue is well known. You see it in most German collections. My friend looked into a tall mirror just as he was lifting his foot to a stool to dry it, and he was reminded of the statue. He smiled and told me of his discovery. As a matter of fact, I'd noticed it too at the same moment, but I don't know if it was to test the quality of his apparent grace or to provide a salutary counter to his vanity. I laughed and said he must be imagining things, and he blushed. He lifted his foot a second time to show me, but the effort was a failure, as anybody could have foreseen. He tried it a third time and a fourth time. He must have lifted the foot 10 times, but it was in vain. He was quite unable to reproduce the same movement. What am I saying? The movements he made were so comical that I was hard put to it not to laugh. From that day, from that very moment, an extraordinary change came over this boy. He began to spend whole days before the mirror. His attractions slipped away from him, one after the other. An invisible and incomprehensible power seemed to settle like a steel net over the free play of his gestures. A year later, nothing remained of the lovely grace which had given pleasure to all who looked at him. I can tell you of a man still alive who was a witness to this strange and unfortunate event. He can confirm it word for word, just as I have described it. In this connection, said my friend warmly, I must tell you another story. You will easily see how it fits in here. When I was on my way to Russia, I spent some time on the estate of a Baltic nobleman whose sons had a passion for fencing. The elder one in particular, who had just come down from the university, thought he was a bit of an expert. One morning, when I was in his room, he offered me a sword. I accepted his challenge, but as it turned out, I had the better of him, and it made him angry, and this increased his confusion. Nearly every thrust I made found its mark. At last his sword flew into the corner of the room, and as I picked it up, he said, half in anger, half in jest, that he had met his master, but that there is a master for everyone and everything, and now he proposed to lead me to mine. The brothers laughed loudly at this and shouted, "Come on, down to the shed." They took me by the hand and led me outside to make the acquaintance of a bear, which their father was rearing on the farm. I was astonished to see the bear standing upright on his hind legs, his back against the post to which he was chained, his right paw raised, ready for battle. He looked me straight in the eye. This was his fighting posture. I wasn't sure if I was dreaming, seeing such an opponent. They urged me to attack. "Ha! See if you can hit him," they shouted. As I had now recovered somewhat from my astonishment, I fell on him with my sword. The bear made a slight movement with his paw and parried my thrust. I feinted to deceive him. The bear did not move. I attacked again, this time with all the skill I could muster. I know I would certainly have thrust my way through to a human breast, but the bear made a slight movement with his paw and parried my thrust. By now I was almost in the same state as the elder brother had been. The bear's utter seriousness robbed me of my composure. Thrusts and feints followed thick and fast. The sweat poured off me, but in vain. It wasn't merely that the bear parried my thrusts like the finest fencer in the world. No, when I feinted to deceive him, he made no move at all. No human fencer could equal his perception in this respect. He stood upright, his paw raised ready for battle, his eye fixed on mine as if he could read my soul. And when my thrusts were not meant seriously, he did not move. "Do you believe this story?" "Absolutely," I said, with joyful approval. "I'd believe it from a stranger. It's so probable. Why should I not believe it from you?" "Now, my excellent friend," said my companion, "you are in possession of all you need to follow my argument. We see that in the organic world, as thought grows dimmer and weaker, grace emerges more brilliantly and decisively. But just as a section drawn through two lines suddenly reappears on the other side after passing through infinity, or as the image in a concave mirror turns up again right in front of us after dwindling to a distance, so grace itself returns when knowledge has, as it were, gone through an infinity. Grace appears most purely in that human form which either has no consciousness or an infinite consciousness, that is to say, in the puppet or in the god." "Does that mean," I said in some bewilderment, "that we must eat again of the tree of knowledge in order to return to the state of innocence?" "Of course," he said. "But that is the final chapter in the history of the world."